It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's no secret there are a lot of big issues at stake in the 2024 presidential election. Among those issues are health care, health coverage, and the future of the Affordable Care Act. Former President Donald Trump, the frontrunner on the Republican side, has been campaigning on a promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. His efforts to do that fell short in his term in office. Meanwhile, ACA marketplace coverage has seen record enrollment in each of the last 3 years. According to the Biden administration's announcement yesterday, more than 21 million Americans sign up for health care insurance plans in those marketplaces. And Democratic President Joe Biden is leaning into the issue of reproductive health, recently announcing efforts to increase access to birth control and emergency abortion services. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How big of an election issue is health care for you? What responses do you have to what each candidate has said about health care in the United States? Have you used the Affordable Care Act one way or another, including finding health insurance in the marketplace? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie Rovner is Chief Washington Correspondent for KFF Health News, where she hosts the weekly podcast, What the Health? Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Affordable Care Act. Julie, since you wrote a little bit about the presidential race and since we reached out to you, we've got new numbers when it comes to enrollment in the marketplace. What are the long-term trends you're seeing when it comes to using different aspects of the Affordable Care Act and its popularity?
Well, as you mentioned, enrollment is up dramatically. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the last couple of years, Congress has approved big discounts for people who are buying their own coverage, much larger subsidies. So that's made it much more affordable for many people who perhaps had wanted health insurance but thought they still couldn't afford it. We've also seen this year, and I know this has happened in Wisconsin too, many, many people disenrolled from the Medicaid program because states were required to keep them on the rolls during the pandemic, and that requirement ended this past year in April. So a lot of people were cut loose from Medicaid, and it turns out that many of them were eligible for some of these big subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. But another reason that we have a lot more people who are getting coverage through the ACA is that since 2017, the last time President Trump tried to repeal the ACA, we've had another half a dozen states expand Medicaid. So there are a lot more people who are eligible who are now basically getting their coverage. Not surprisingly, the public polling that we've done at KFF has found that the law is the most popular that it has ever been. So we're in a much different place in 2024 than we were in 2017.
And the Affordable Care Act is more than just the marketplaces. What else in the Affordable Care Act do you see attributing maybe to some of that, contributing to some of that popularity?
Well, a lot of things have been popular in the Affordable Care Act that people never knew were part of the Affordable Care Act. Things like no-cost preventive care through your insurance, no matter what kind of insurance you have. There are allowing your kids to stay on their parents' health plans until they're age 26, banning extra costs in insurance for pre-existing conditions. There are lots and lots of very popular pieces of this law. The problem was a lot of people didn't realize that's where it came from.
Let's turn to the candidates now that we've set things up with the Affordable Care Act. Former President Trump was critical of the act, worked with members of Congress to try to repeal it. That fell short by John McCain's vote, in effect. What are we hearing from the former president now as he seeks a second non-sequential term?
Well, he's still saying that Obamacare is terrible, and he has promised a couple of times I've seen to have something to replace it with. But, you know, during his entire 4 years in office, we never actually did see a replacement plan. And interestingly, what John McCain ended up turning thumbs down on was not really a replacement plan either. It was a proposal to basically kick the can down the road for another 2 months to see if they could come up with something. That was what eventually went down when the Republican Senate was working on it.
Have we seen any indication either from former President Trump or Republican leaders of what a Affordable Care Act replacement might look at, supposing that there's a Republican president in 2024 and a Republican Congress who will go along with that?
Well, we do know that they would like to roll back some of the Medicaid programs, certainly the Medicaid expansions of the Affordable Care Act. President Trump, when he was in office, wanted to have work requirements for people on Medicaid, although it was discovered that most people on Medicaid already work, or they are disabled themselves or taking care of a family member. So basically, the people on Medicaid who can work already do. But in order to really replace the marketplaces where people would go and get insurance if they were otherwise unavailable to them, we've never seen the Republicans come up with a plan to replace that because they don't agree amongst themselves on how to do it.
Now, turning to President Biden, now as vice president, he described the Affordable Care Act passage as a big deal. I think I'm cleaning up the language a little bit. What have we seen from the Biden administration when it comes to maintaining and or enhancing the Affordable Care Act?
We've seen a lot of things behind the scenes. One of the things President Trump did was cut out all of the outreach and enrollment assistance. The Biden administration put all of that back in. They extended the time period for people to sign up, the annual open enrollment period. They beefed up the number of people who could help people sign up, both call centers and people in person. So there were a lot of things that people didn't necessarily see that basically greased the skids and made it possible for more people to sign up. And of course, in addition, were these, with the help of Congress, these much larger subsidies for people.
And one criticism, I think, from Republicans and conservatives is, okay, yes, the enhanced coverage may sound nice. It costs money. This is tax money going into these higher subsidies. Maybe this is spending too much on top of an already expensive Affordable Care Act.
It does cost money, and it costs more money than it did at the beginning because the subsidies are bigger. I mean, this is the payoff for, do you want people to have insurance? And if so, it's going to cost money. Cost money for Medicare and Medicaid, too. So this is what Congress is going to have to decide. These enhanced subsidies are temporary, and they expire after this year. So Congress is going to have to renew them and find the money to do that if they're going to stay in place.
Julie Rovner is with us, Chief Washington Correspondent for KFF Health News. You can hear her on the What the Health podcast. We are looking at healthcare issues in the presidential campaign this year. You can join in with your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, other parts of healthcare in the United States. If there's a candidate you trust more with these issues, if there are changes you'd like to see, if you have questions, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to reproductive health care. Julie, former President Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices. They contributed to overturning a Roe v. Wade, which set us up for where we are now with abortion access in the U.S. What have we heard from former President Trump as he navigates this on the campaign trail?
What was interesting early on when he first said that he was going to run again, he criticized many of the very strict state bans, saying that, you know, it was contrary to what most people wanted, which is true, and that it was not good politics, which at the time was also true. But of course, he's been very strongly supported by evangelicals and by anti-abortion groups, and they came down on him like a ton of bricks. And in the last several weeks, he's kind of changed his tune again, saying he's proud of his role in overturning Roe v. Wade. And he would like to see some kind of a ban. So he's sort of trying to please his primary, you know, audience, the audience in the primaries, and reach out to some of the general election voters, too. It's a very tricky balancing act. Nobody has ever been able to do it. We'll see if he can.
And speaking of the primary, Nikki Haley, former South Carolina governor, former UN ambassador, got some attention in the earlier Republican primary debates for, you know, describing herself as very pro-life, but acknowledging, she said, a reality that there need to be compromises. I think people view her campaign maybe as a long shot now, but thoughts on Nikki Haley presenting a Republican take, a Republican alternative on abortion?
Yeah, I heard some interviews with New Hampshire voters saying that they thought she was sort of more moderate and open to compromise on abortion. And that's probably not true. She is very, very strongly pro-life. One of the things she talked about in this is true, is that it's going to be very difficult to get anything through Congress because neither side has ever had the 60 votes that it would take to overcome a Senate filibuster. But she, you know, even though she sort of tried to walk away from it, she signed many pieces of very anti-abortion legislation when she was governor of South Carolina, and she has suggested that she would do the same if it came to her as president. She's simply suggesting that it would be unlikely to come to her. But as president can do an awful lot in this realm, particularly to make abortion less available. President Biden has done what he can to make it more available. A Republican or pro-life president could roll all that back.
And then the Roe v. Wade anniversary was just a few days ago. President Biden took the opportunity to promote abortion access, to raise it as an election issue with those general election voters you were just mentioning, Julie. What are we seeing from the Biden administration?
Well, of course, President Biden himself was an opponent of abortion. He's a strong Catholic, as most people know, and he's not very comfortable with this issue. But it is a big issue for Democrats. Vice President Harris has carried a lot of the weight on this issue. She's been out and about working on it. But President knows that this is important to his voters, and he really has come a little more front and center. The administration, as I mentioned, has done a number of things to try and make abortion as available as they can, using what levers they have in the federal government, which are not that many.
We're talking about health care and the 2024 election with Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for KFF Health News and host of the What the Health podcast. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about health care and health care related issues in the 2024 presidential campaign. What questions do you have for our guest? Is health care an issue that you think might motivate you to vote this year? The Affordable Care Act, abortion access, so whichever side of either of those you might be on. What do you want to hear from the candidates on these issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about health care and the 2024 election with Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for KFF Health News, host of the What the Health podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is health care an important issue for you in the 2024 presidential campaign? Have you gotten coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplace? How did it work for you? Are there things you think could be done better? Should it be repealed? If so, replaced with what? Do you have questions about any of the candidates and their thoughts on healthcare policy? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie, we heard from a caller in Superior who says he gets health insurance through the marketplace, but would prefer that money go to a health savings account for when he needs health care. And that's been proposed for some years now as an alternative to something like the Affordable Care Act, Julie, making health savings accounts more accessible. Is that something that's a leading policy idea in Washington now, though?
A long time. I mean, there's nothing preventing him from opening his own health savings account. This is where people can put away money tax-free and then use it for medical expenses. Obviously, if you don't have very high medical expenses, it's not otherwise tax-deductible. So they can be pretty popular, although they're mostly for people who have enough money to put away for that, or whose employers put money in their health savings accounts. They're not very useful if you don't have the money to actually sock away in the first place. But it does accrue tax-free. Anything that it earns is tax-free, and people do like them. It's not considered a replacement for having insurance, though. It's mostly an adjunct to it.
In your piece, Julie, you looked at public health, and obviously President Trump was in office when COVID hit us, and then President Biden picked up the efforts after that. And you point out a paradox. One of the, I think, things that most experts agree the Trump administration did pretty well was the Operation Warp Speed to get a vaccine developed and support efforts to do that. Is that something President Trump is bragging about much on the campaign trail?
Not really, because we've seen this very sort of anti-vax feeling it's I won't call it pervasive yet, but there's certainly more than there used to be. And a lot of those are Republicans, and a lot of them are Trump supporters. They don't trust the government. They don't trust the COVID vaccine. They don't trust any vaccines, many of them. So it's not something that he's really wanted to trumpet, although it's ironic because it really was sort of a very impressive action to get that vaccine basically from being on paper to being in people's arms in a year.
And Trump's handling of COVID, it got criticism from some people in the public health profession and certainly from Democrats for not being assertive enough, for not talking plainly about the risks of the disease early on. On the other hand, former Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, now out of the presidential primary race, criticized Trump for doing too much and for allowing partial shutdowns around the country. Can you talk about how the former president can navigate that?
It's hard. I think it's hard for every public official. No one knew what to do when COVID struck. No one was alive the last time we had, a national pandemic, which was in the 1920s. So public health was doing the best they could. Everybody's talking about how, they lied this and they lied that. That's not how it works. You don't know much. As you get more information, you change your advice. As you get still more information, you change your advice again. And I think both President Trump and President Biden had been tripped up by that. It's very difficult to basically go after a moving target. Although President Trump was a lot looser with some of the things that he said, I think, than President Biden was.
And then President Biden comes into office after the 2020 elections. What are your observations on how he picked things up with the early days of the vaccination campaign and leading up to the end of the COVID declared public health emergency?
Well, President Biden came into office with obviously 4 years of having been vice president, however many years in the Senate, and he knows how the federal government works and how the federal sort of health bureaucracy works. So I think it was much easier for him to actually get things in order. He set up a task force. He brought in somebody who was, very experienced in the federal government, and they carried out what their mission was, which was to get people vaccinated and to try and get some straight information to people about the continuing dangers of COVID as the information, became more reliable. But by that time, so many people were so dubious that even President Biden had a difficult time with it.
Now, I had actually pitched this idea. Hey, I see Julie Ravner wrote about health care in this election. It's a big issue. It affects a lot of people. The callers are not coming out in droves here, Julie. And I wonder, is this an issue you think is on people's minds for this election, or is it crowded out by all the other stuff?
I think it will be. I think it's just starting to be. People are just starting to talk about it. I know that, obviously immigration is taking up a lot of the air right now. President Trump's legal problems are also taking up a lot of the air right now. And, the Republicans are trying to talk down the economy. The problem for them is that most of the economic news that we've had of late has been very good. So there will be arguing about that. I think as we get into the summer, as we get into more of the general election, the differences will become more stark between the Democrats and Republicans about particularly reproductive health, abortion, but also contraception and the future of the Affordable Care Act. I think those are going to be two very big issues.
We're talking to Julie Ravner, Chief Washington Correspondent for KFF Health News, looking at issues related to health care in the 2024 presidential election. Let's bring on a caller. Brad is with us in Delavan. Brad, hi.
Hi. Hey, as much as I would have hated for Donald Trump to win the 2020 election, if he had won it, I think that people on the far right would not have had any resistance at all to taking the vaccine. If anything, I think it would have been a sacrament for them to go to the go to Mar-a-Lago or go to the Trump Hotel to get their vaccine card stamped with Donald Trump's face on it.
Brad, thanks for the call. It's a counterfactual, Julie. We can't know for sure, but it does speak to the way that our political polarization extends its way into the healthcare world.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would be the case. I have had that same thought. Would a second-term President Trump have been able to talk his base into trusting the vaccine and into trusting public health? But I think a lot of that was starting to bubble up before 2020, Ed. That's the, sort of the source of Governor DeSantis's criticism of President Trump. So there was already sort of distrust coming up from the grassroots. And I obviously will never know what would have happened, but I'm not positive that everybody would have just gone along happily.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. In our last minute or so, Julie, how much control does a president have in their own person over key healthcare matters as opposed to what they, you know, would need Congress to accomplish?
Well, obviously, it depends on the issue, and it depends on whether the president needs money or needs a law change. But the fact is, presidents can have a lot to do with doing things like making it more difficult for people to sign up for the Affordable Care Act and making it more difficult for women to get reproductive health. So it's easier for a Republican president to use presidential powers to block things than it is for a Democratic president to use presidential power to expand things. That's obviously the reverse on other things, if it's things that the Republicans want to do and the Democrats don't. So there is a fair bit of executive power, but you can't push things too far without Congress going along.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Anytime.
That's Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for KFF Health News, where she hosts the weekly podcast, What the Health? We talked to her today about healthcare policy and the U.S. presidential election. Hey, we still want to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Want to hear how these issues we've been talking about affect you or maybe your family? Have you or someone you know relied on the Affordable Care Act marketplace to get healthcare coverage for years at a time or maybe during one short stint? How did it work out for you? Were you able to find coverage worth having in the first place? Did the subsidy changes over the last couple of years affect you, maybe make things easier for you? Do you want to see them stick around, even though, as we heard from Julie, they are kind of expensive? And how about abortion access in your community? Is that something that shapes what you think about the presidential campaign? Let us know. You can email. You can always email us. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Border Patrol agents can remove razor wire installed along the U.S.-Mexico border by authorities in Texas. State officials say the razor wire is there to deter migrants from entering the state. This ruling blocked a previous order from the Fifth Circuit Federal Appeals Court affirming that Texas could put up the razor wire and ordering federal Border Patrol officers not to cut those wires while performing their duties, except in limited circumstances. This week's ruling is part of an ongoing dispute between Texas and the federal government when it comes to border enforcement. Our next guest joins us for a look at how this latest development fits into the history of the U.S.-Mexico border and what to watch for as the story develops. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following this, do you agree with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling this week? How much authority do you think Texas or other border states should have over securing their border with Mexico? What kind of security and resources would you like to see at the border? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Ida Buff is professor of history at UW-Milwaukee. Her most recent publication is a bilingual book called A is for Asylum Seeker, Words for People on the Move. That's the English version. Adiasilo, Palabras para Personas en Movimiento in Spanish. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Can you give us a little sense of how this whole thing got started with Texas, in effect, installing its own border installations, coming into conflict with the federal Border Patrol?
Well, it depends on how much time you have. So just to give a short summary of recent events, In 2022, Texas Governor Greg Abbott inaugurated what's called Operation Lone Star, which to date has cost the taxpayers of Texas $4.5 billion and getting more expensive every day. And Abbott's position has been that the federal government is not doing its job in securing the border. So he will begin doing what Texas needs to do to protect the Texas border. This is in very clear violation of two very important provisions of our Constitution, the plenary powers doctrine, which comes out of the Article 1 of the Constitution, which says that Congress has jurisdiction over interactions with foreign entities, including, which has been read historically to include immigration, and the supremacy clause, which is from Article 6, which says that the federal government has the last say over state policy. So what we, and I could go back further if you want me to, or if callers want to talk about the deep history of this, because this particular conflict has been going on for a very long time at the border, at least since we could say 1929 when the Border Patrol is founded. We could say 1848 when a huge swath of Mexico, including much of Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, California, et cetera, become the United States from being Mexico at the conclusion of the Mexican-American War. This is an old story that has been continually rebooted by Republicans because it's an arena that generates popularity and voting for them. So they continually say there's a crisis at the border, it endangers American communities. There's a xenophobic spin machine taking place at the border, and Governor Abbott, who would very much like to be the vice presidential nominee with candidate Trump, Governor Abbott loves this publicity. If you think about the people of Texas three winters ago, when their power grid collapsed and there was a cold snap and there were no resources for them, part of the reason that there aren't resources for improving infrastructure, Texas public schools, improving policing. Remember that South Texas is the home of Uvalde, where there was recently finding that the police completely didn't conduct themselves well during a school shooting, resulting in the terrible, tragic deaths of very young students and teachers. All of that money has been sucked away by Operation Lone Star, which is essentially Governor Abbott grandstanding for the extremist white nationalist Republican Party.
Now, the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, this is a big, broad issue. It seems like this is a kind of narrow argument over the Border Patrol agents cutting through this razor wire. The argument from Texas Attorney General was the razor wire is there to deter people from coming in. The argument from the U.S. Border Patrol was, yeah, but it's keeping us from doing our enforcement job. How narrow do you read this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court?
It is a very narrow and close, it was 5-4, and fairly fraught ruling. Like, you can kind of read between the lines and see that the court is like, we don't want to take on the whole vexed issue of immigration. And it's important to say that it's rare for a historian like me to find myself in the position of extolling the virtues of the Border Patrol, who are often the first contacts with people trying to come across the border. There have been lots of cases of abuse of migrants at the hands of Border Patrol. But in this case, what Governor Abbott and Operation Lone Star have done is literally wrap floating barrels in razor wire to intentionally do the maximal harm to people who are trying to swim across the Rio Grande with their children for their lives. And it's not just a matter of the Border Patrol as enforcement. Last week, a woman trying to cross with her two young children drowned because of the obstacles placed in the river, and the Border Patrol could not get through the obstacles placed there by the state of Texas in time to save their lives. So really what we're talking about is murder by the state of Texas of migrants, and it's part of this huge media spectacle that generates, you know, there's like a rotating cast of politicians into Eagle Pass. Some of them fly in for the afternoon, right? They don't talk to migrants. They talk to people who are promoting this notion of injury by migrants. And in this case, I have to say, the Border Patrol cutting down the razor wire. Like, if you know anything about razor wire, it's very specifically designed not just to scratch you if you go by it, but to like embed itself in your arm or your leg so you can't get it's designed to tear flesh. This is a violent militarization of the border, and it's not the only aspect of Operation Lone Star that actually is a murderous, violent action towards people trying to cross.
One of the arguments, again, from Texas in this case is that they are trying to provide a very visible deterrent for people crossing in non-authorized points of entry that can be dangerous even just based on their own natural characteristics, much less the additional things. So with this high publicity campaign, the hope is, at the very least, you channel asylum seekers into recognized ports of entry. Do you see any chance that that could be effective?
What we have seen is more and more, you know, if you take the campaign to kind of, and let's just say, the notion that the border will be completely closed is an idealistic and false one. But if you take campaigns that start, let's say, in the late 70s and early 80s, like the Light Up the Border campaign in San Diego, where sort of vigilante citizens would drive to the border and, you know, beam their headlights so that people crossing would be apprehended and scared. And, you know, what we've seen is the border getting more and more militarized, more and more difficult for people to cross. People have been pushed away by U.S. policy from crossing where the border, where it's safe, to crossing in areas that are very treacherous terrain, that get very cold at night and very hot by day, where there isn't water, where there are lots of rattlesnakes. That has been U.S. policy, right? So it's very disingenuous for someone like Governor Abbott, and he's not alone. There's Rick DeSantis, who's not a border state, but who's a huge fan of this stuff. There have been different border state governors doing this. It is disingenuous and actually inopportune for them to be presenting, oh, we're gonna fix this. Immigration legally is the purview of the federal government. Now, there hasn't been immigration policy made in Congress, which has the right to make immigration policy, since 1996. So the frustration is understandable because we have had sort of a hesitancy by Democratic politicians like Joe Biden that, you know, have been hesitant to bring us the immigration reform that we need. But it's really important to say there's going to be more and more people coming. Many of the people coming to our borders are coming because U.S. blockade of Venezuela has made it impossible to work and eat there, because Hurricane Otis took out their entire village, right? We're going to have more and more people coming as a result of U.S. foreign policy and unadulterated climate change, right? So we have to think very carefully at this moment about what public safety is, about who is the public and how they are safe, you know, and what we know from American history is that when we hear about states' rights and that immigration should be the purview of the states or abortion should be the purview of the states, it is almost never good for individual civil rights. If you think about the Dobbs decision 2 years ago, which said abortion is no longer a national right, the states can decide. And now we have more than half of the states in the country saying, oh, women don't have that right, right? This is the same move. Like, oh, this should be the right of the states. This is not going to break well for migrants or for the predominantly Latinx communities that are close to our south border, who are more and more surveilled and policed and harassed as part of this clean up the border, you know, xenophobic, racist, let's keep them from coming to our country. Well, we have always been them. This is a false, racist, xenophobic distinction, and it's all we have, all the Republicans have, in terms of generating, getting people upset and driving them to the polls. So it's very intentional. If you think about the timing, just as the primary season starts, you know, this is about causing trouble and creating visibility.
Rachel Ida Buff is with us, professor of history at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about border security and a U.S. Supreme Court ruling confirming federal jurisdiction over the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas, specifically allowing federal border officials to remove razor wire installed by state officials there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on these claims from the state of Texas that they can take on border security issues. Do you think states at the border should be able to do that? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with historian Rachel Buff from UW-Milwaukee about the latest conflict between Texas Governor Greg Abbott and the Biden administration over border policy. The U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the U.S. federal government has jurisdiction over the border in a dispute over razor wire placed by the state of Texas at the border. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hello. We have no borders. If we had borders, we'd have a U.S. Marshals Service, mobile units at all the borders. We'd have clinics, okay? We'd be vetting these people. We send them back 6-7 times. They come back as drug dealers, traffickers, and human traffickers and cartels. It's time we address this.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Rachel, Mary Kay, not alone in that concern that the border situation could be abused by drug cartels and others.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate Mary Kay's concern. And unfortunately, I'm not going to get to speak to her directly. But I want to say that we need to be very careful here about disaggregating what are fairly inflated and very scary claims, which I hear Mary Kay reacting to, which is completely understandable. Understand, Mary Kay, that the drug cartels are not going to be stopped by border enforcement. Border enforcement is a very expensive game of building walls and militarizing our borders, and they do not stop the international cartels. Why? Because it's good for business on both sides of the border. There have been multiple cases of Border Patrol agents who have been evidently helping out the cartels. The cartels have a lot of money and power. So let's take the drug cartels off the table. Drug cartels, bad. Stopped by border enforcement? Absolutely not. As for human trafficking, again, another disgusting procedure that we don't want to support. But did you know that one of the main sources of accusation of human trafficking is grandmas bringing their grandkids across the border, or a trusted relative bringing those kids, or even parents bringing their kids across the border? This started in the Trump administration. There were allegations that bringing your children across, and let's be clear what this means. This means you left your town in Honduras after getting death threats against your 13-year-old because he didn't want to join Las Maras, the gangs who are involved with the drug cartels. He said, no, because you raised him right. And they said, we're going to kill your family. So you grab that kid and you get out and you walk across Honduras and across the dangerous Darien Gap all the way through Mexico, right? And you walk there and you get to the U.S. border only to be prevented from crossing and seeking safety for your family. And then as a parent who protected the kid against joining the gang, against being murdered by the gang for not joining, you are accused of human trafficking. So Mary Kay, please, I understand that you're upset. It is an upsetting, we hear very upsetting things, but it is important to read critically about who is human trafficking and who is trying to save their family, and I want to make very clear that the drug cartels exist because of sanctions for them on both sides of the border, in the Mexican government and in the U.S. government. So it is not, I would not advise you to think that throwing more money at border enforcement is going to clean up either of those problems. And I would also ask you to reach down in your heart and your soul and think about how you feel about other humans. Maybe people who aren't as lucky as you are. I don't know you. I don't know your situation. I don't know your struggles. But I do know that as a parent and maybe you're a parent too, I don't know, I would do just about anything to save my kids from being murdered by a gang. So if we can just take a minute here and imagine that Honduran parent, imagine that Haitian parent who did everything, who risked all kinds of death on rough seas, in difficult climes, etc., to save their kids. Don't we want a country? Because I know my relatives came here this way. They came fleeing a dangerous place for them in Europe. Don't we want to be that nation that lifts a lamp and opens the golden door? Or do we slam it shut because of what are essentially false rumors about who's coming in?
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Chris joins us now in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So my question here is, has there been actors, either foreign or domestic, that are using this for political gain as far as sending a false message throughout, whether it's Central America, Africa, what have you, that are artificially driving inflation numbers? I recently was watching a piece of Peter Zion in regards to Finland and Russia, where they were using social media to kind of drive people towards the Finnish border artificially. Do you think there's any evidence to support anything like that?
Chris, thanks for the call. Rachel, do you see that a campaign to promote people moving toward the United States as a political effort? Or is it, as you were saying, the conditions at home, Honduras, Venezuela, elsewhere, that's driving people to seek to come to the U.S.?
That's a really good question, Chris. Thank you. I mean, I think you and I both know that the internet is a freak show on the dance floor and all sorts of stuff is going on out there. False, fake news, all kinds of things. And, you know, surely there are all kinds of actors who are trying to exploit and take advantage of vulnerable people. Absolutely. But I want to take issue with something that was inherent in what you said and that I think is worth taking apart a little. One of the claims of Governor Abbott is, you know, Donald Trump and, you know, all of, you know, many of the Republicans is that we're at an all-time high of immigration encounters. The border is out of control. Let me tell you as a historian that the phrase the border is out of control has been pretty popular since 1954. And it's really politically useful. And the numbers don't work. And here's why the numbers don't work. If we count in terms of encounters of law enforcement, and that's the number that's very inflated right now, yes, the numbers are high, but that includes multiple encounters. And it includes two kinds of encounters. One is a border patrol who meets somebody crossing the border, and another is a border patrol who deports someone back across the border. What I just said, apprehension and deportation, that's one person that gets two numbers. So what we're dealing with here, and I think this is where the fake news is most important to be careful of, is that these are kind of ginned up statistics meant to cause panic, right? Another thing is that over the past decades, particularly since the Trump administration, but even before then, we have collectively decided, and again, we haven't had federal immigration policy for a very long time, but incrementally, really since the Reagan administration and Clinton participated in this and Obama participated in this, it's bipartisan, right? We've decided that the international law that the U.S. is a signatory of around asylum seekers, which says, if you fear persecution in your nation of origin, you can come to the United States, put one foot across the border and say, hey, I need help. We've somehow decided that that is an apprehendable, deportable, detainable crime, right? So yeah, that has driven numbers up. It happens to be in flagrant violation of international law that we are signatories to. It happens to violate the very spirit of the UNHCR, the United Nations High Council on Refugees. It happens to be wrong legally, politically, and morally. But yeah, it does drive up those numbers. So once again, we have to be really careful consumers, just as Chris, your comment says, like, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff floating around on the internet, which I'm totally with you. It's wild out there. But we have to be really careful because a lot of that stuff gets recycled and makes it into our 24-hour news cycle and causes people to really feel that somehow our American way of life is under siege at the border, which I want to tell you that it absolutely is not. Is the soul of our nation under siege? Absolutely. And it's by immigration enforcement.
Rachel, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today. That's Rachel Ida Buff, professor of history at UW-Milwaukee. She was with us for a look at this week's Supreme Court ruling about razor wire at the Texas border, what it means, the ongoing dispute between Texas and the Biden administration over border policy. Last Friday, Republican Senator Ron Johnson talked to WPR's The Morning Show about border security and government funding. You can listen to what Senator Johnson had to say by visiting WPR.org/mornings. You might have seen this in the news, a dispute over tea between the U.S. and Great Britain. I don't think we'll go to war over it this time, though. As reported in the New York Times, it all started with a chemistry professor in the U.S. who wrote a book on the science of tea. It included a recommendation that to keep tea from getting too bitter, especially when it is steeped a long time, you could put a tiny pinch of salt in it. Okay, now then the British tabloid press and TV picked that story up, and as you might guess, they gave a very calm and measured look at the science behind the idea. Oh no, wait, they basically ran with the story, American ruins tea by pouring salt in it. U.S. Embassy in London got involved in the fun with a statement that, quote, the unthinkable notion of adding salt to Britain's national drink is not official United States policy. The core idea of salt in tea, the chemist says it goes back at least 12 centuries with salt included in a Chinese tea recipe. Am I going to try it? Probably not, but you can take the advice with or without a grain of salt. Spilling all that tea, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The top two candidates in the Republican presidential primary have recently drawn some criticism for views they expressed about the U.S. Civil War. Started with former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who didn't mention slavery when asked in New Hampshire about the causes of the Civil War.
I mean, I think the cause of the Civil War was basically how government was going to run, the freedoms and what people could and couldn't do.
The next day at a New Hampshire town hall event, Haley clarified her comment to include slavery in her explanation.
Of course the Civil War was about slavery. We know that. That's unquestioned. Always the case, we know the Civil War was about slavery. But it was also more than that. It was about the freedoms of every individual. It was about the role of government.
Former President Donald Trump criticized Haley for not initially talking about slavery. He later added his own thoughts on the Civil War during a speech in Iowa.
I was thinking to myself because I was reading something, and I said, this is something that could have been negotiated. You know, it was just for all those people to die, and they died viciously. That was a vicious, vicious war. And in many ways, look, they're all this nothing nice about it. But boy, that was a tough one for our country. But I think it's, Abraham Lincoln. Of course, if you negotiated it, you probably wouldn't even know who Abraham Lincoln was. He would have been president, but he would have been president. He wouldn't have been the Abraham Lincoln would have been different, but that would have been okay.
Civil War historians have pushed back on both Haley's and Trump's characterizations of the war. The controversy brings up broader questions about how we talk about the Civil War and why we still ask politicians about it more than 150 years later. Our next guest researches the history of cultural and intellectual thought in the U.S. She's with us to talk about how the idea of the Civil War has been used in different ways over the decades. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to those comments we heard from the leading Republican primary candidates? Do you think it's important for us to keep talking about the Civil War in 2024? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is the Merle Curdy and Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor of History at UW-Madison. She's the author of a lot of books, including The Ideas That Made America a Brief History. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me back.
So people might wonder why we're asking our politicians about the Civil War in 2024. why is it important to hear our politicians' perspectives on this pivotal event in U.S. history?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that the answer that the politicians give are not historical answers, but they're political. Yeah, so they're not really about trying to give us a fuller view of the past. They're about making a political statement about now and also about where they see the country going in the future. But we ask the question, Rob, or it gets asked, I should say, because it is a Rorschach test for so many other crucial issues.
What kind of issues?
Well, the first one is obvious. Race, racism, what they think about the legacy of slavery, whether they think that there's something like systematic racism with us still today. Another one that interestingly doesn't get talked about a lot, but I think it will, as I think this question about the Civil War is going to keep coming up, just even, regardless of whether Haley stays in the race or not. And that is because the question about the Civil War is a Rorschach test on what you think about states' rights. And right now, post-Roe, this is a very pressing question in a way that it hasn't been for decades. Although, of course, the whole dynamics of it are different. But again, there can be something very illuminating in how much you lean into a state's rights argument in the context of a post-Roe America. And then the last thing, Rob, is just it does give you some window of the candidate's broader historical sense, which again is less about what they think about history, but more an opportunity to see what they think about America today, especially what they think about American democracy today.
This isn't the first time politicians have disputed the causes of the Civil War, the run-up to the Civil War. Can you talk about the idea of the Civil War as an intellectual war of sorts in American politics in the decades since the war itself?
You put it very nicely. It's an intellectual war or battle of ideas over, you know, a battle over the idea of the Civil War. Who has a proprietary stake? Who has a claim? I think what's important is that every time the Civil War is invoked in some sort of political discussion, it's invoked to do political work. Yeah. And so there are as many civil wars in American intellectual history since 1865, as there are people who have put it to use, right? For a campaign, for a piece of artwork, for a monument. So part of the answer to that question, Rob, is really in what are the particular contexts in which there's even an uptick in interest in the Civil War, and how is it getting used?
I've seen the argument, Jennifer, that yes, the Union won the war itself, but by about 1920 or so, the Southern states, the former Confederate states, had won that battle of ideas in a lot of ways in shaping how we talked about the Civil War and what showed up in kids' textbooks and things like that. Can you talk about that turning point in the way we talked about the Civil War?
There's a famous quote that the North won the war and the South won the peace. And that's just one way of saying another version of what you're saying, which is that eventually the South was able to put forth a kind of master narrative that had a lot of traction. And that one of them that is, you know, the lost cause narrative. So sort of the romance about the Confederacy going down for a cause worth fighting for, which was their own sovereignty, their own self-determination. It wasn't explicit that, of course, it was really fundamentally about slavery. But there's another way in which we could say that the South, that is to say the pre-Civil War South or the pre-Reunion South, Union South, won the war. And that is that we never really fully worked through what to do about the systemic racism that undergirded slavery. It very quickly turned into something called the Black Codes. And then it very quickly, you know, after that turned into Jim Crow. And Jim Crow was with us well into the 20th century. So I think in that regard, if you will, the white supremacy that undergirded the whole Southern economics and the whole Southern way of life, that stayed with us long past the last battles.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, history professor, UW-Madison, talking about how we talk about the U.S. Civil War, its causes, its consequences. Still in 2024 on the presidential campaign trail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Dwayne is with us in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? For a lot of jobs in our country, we have to actually take a test for like driving and stuff like that. And we got politicians that go in and try to get our votes and do all this other stuff. Maybe we should start having them actually take a test prior to trying to take the job for civics or history in general, because a lot of these people that are spouting off their mouth, they're not paying attention to what they're doing. And a lot of these people think that they actually passed high school and they've done something. So why do we as a country not take this job? I mean, taking the job as a president more seriously and learning about our history before they even think they can fix it.
Dwayne, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, I don't think we'd ever have a formal test you'd have to pass to become president. I think the Constitution allows that. But in a sense, that is a thing that voters can test their candidates on.
Yeah, that's a great question, Dwayne. I mean, I think one of the things that's funny you mentioned testing is that actually this is, I don't recall a presidential campaign where so much talk about cognitive testing was part of it. And of course, you know, that's because of Trump's taking, the cognitive tests while he was in office and then quote unquote acing them. And then, of course, questions about Biden's mental fitness in his advanced age. And we've got two either octogenarians or almost octogenarians. So the question of their mental fitness is quite real. And that's one we don't really know how to address, though I know that the question is a little different. It's not just their cognitive capabilities. It's called like just their basic understanding of history. I think the reason why we don't have that is it would break into the kind of history wars that we see are going on right now. Who gets to write those tests? Who writes the questions? Yeah. Do we, on those tests, are we going to say that Rosa Parks was responding to racism? Or are we going to cut it out like the textbooks are doing right now in Florida for middle schoolers? Yeah. I mean, so even the drafting of those tests would be so contentious because there is this fight over the memory of the Civil War.
Dwayne, thanks for the call. We're talking to UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about how we talk about the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War in 2024, and what it says about our society and our leaders, how we talk in 2024, not the Civil War in 2024. You get what I'm saying. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember reading textbooks in school and how it characterized the Civil War before and after? Does your understanding change over time? Do we talk about it differently now, even than when you went to school? What do you want to hear from presidents when asked about the causes of the Civil War, the importance of it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of U.S. intellectual and cultural history at UW-Madison. She's with us today to talk about how we talk about the idea of the U.S. Civil War, with Donald Trump and Nikki Haley recently making some controversial comments about its history on the campaign trail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Kay in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is my topic. I'm a Civil War historian. I concentrate on politics, which I've also been involved in, and finding the critical facts. If you don't find the critical facts, you're not going to talk about it right. And a lot of the history has been written by neo-Confederate men who avoid or somehow just don't discuss the critical facts. Here's the three big critical facts. slavery was started in Virginia among aristocrats. So it's not about the critical race theory. It's about the critical class theory. Slavery oppressed the white working class, which stayed in the South. And so, for instance, in 1860, a former Kentuckian ran for assembly in Illinois, and he said he remembered at age 19 having to rent himself out at $6 a month because slaves were being rented out at $75 a year. He had to undercut slave wages. And secession began to move when California came in as a free state, and it was the first time the South began to lose control of the federal government.
Okay, thanks for the call. Jennifer, a lot from Kay there. Take it where you want to run with it.
Well, thank you, Kay. You'll need to have her on again when this topic comes back in a week or two. There's something that she said that really connected with something that you said earlier, Rob. You said the Civil War in 2024, I mean memories of the Civil War in 2024. And this connects to Kay's talking about critical facts. Here's another thing that's going on in this conversation about the Civil War, is that there are people talking about having another Civil War if their candidate doesn't win. And in this case, it's almost invariably Donald Trump. So what critical facts are missing? You've got 30%, the electorate thinks that Biden did not win the 2020 election, 62% of Republicans, 42% of Republicans think that their vote, worried with that their vote would not count. So if you think your vote doesn't count, you don't believe in democracy. And then it's hard to know what it is you want instead. And so we have these, white right-wing groups very explicitly talking about a civil war, using the symbols of the Civil War as well. And so I just want to draw our attention to the fact that when we're talking about the Civil War, we're not talking about something historical. There's something also there's a threat here that I think is happening. It's not even the level of a dog whistle. I mean, humans can hear this. And so I think there's a kind of double duty that this talk is doing. And and it's in a way that I think is extremely, extremely dangerous. And as a historian, I cannot think of a historical analogy that's comparable that where it was just rhetoric.
Okay, thanks for the call. We'll go to Martha now in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Yeah, hi. See, I wonder if your guest could address this typical conversation that I have with my Republican brothers and sisters when I point out the blatant, in-your-face racism I see in that party these days. And their stock answer is, well, the Republicans ended the Civil War, and, Lincoln was a Republican and blah, blah, blah. But I hope your guest can address the true, people behind the processes of the Civil War breaking out were very right-wing conservatives of all stripes, not just Southern Democrats. Could she address that, please?
Martha, thanks for the call. That and how things may have realigned since then, Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, this is a hard conversation to have. I'm sure it's an exhausting one to have. But it's so important that you're having it. And I think we need more people able and willing to have these sorts of conversations with family members, with friends, with neighbors, where they're literally living in two different worldviews. So one is, as Rob signals, I mean, it wouldn't be hard to sort of point them to history that there's a dramatic realignment in what the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So I just think there would be innumerable examples of where you could show them a sort of shifting up, and I'd be curious, what they would say, so that the term itself, Republican and Democrat, simply does not mean in 2024 what it meant, in the 19th century. And then the other way you could address this would be to simply say, well, let's just lay out what did the Democrats at that time believe in? What was their party platform? What was, what was the political rhetoric, the political commitments? And now let's compare it to the Republicans. And I think I would hope that very quickly your relatives would be able to see that what the Republicans of former days and today's Republicans, there's a yawning abyss between the two.
Thanks again for that call. Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, professor of history at UW-Madison, about how we talk about the U.S. Civil War, some of the intellectual history behind that. Jennifer, I want to go back to the era before the Civil War now. We heard former President Trump talk about the idea of negotiation. And sometimes I think of the Civil War as breaking out, you know, after Lincoln is elected, by the time he's inaugurated. But we have this history, certainly 20 years, probably much longer, actually going back to the founding of this argument over slavery, its future in new states. Can you talk a little bit about the ideas that had been contesting well before 1860?
Ideas regarding
The argument over slavery in the United States in the decades leading up to the Civil War.
I mean, it was the central issue in American life, North and South, East and West. And already instantiated in our own Constitution. I mean, this is the central driving issue of American history. So it's not kind of where does it crop up? It's where does it not crop up? So there's just no episode that you can look to between, let's say, 1776 and 1861, or even go earlier, 1859 with John Brown's raid, often seen as the initiating tick for the start of the Civil War. And the question of slavery, the expansion of slave states, who would be admitted into the Union, under what terms, this is just the key animating theme in American political economic history.
In our last couple of minutes, Jennifer, you're a professor, you work with students. What kind of things are you talking with them about these days, maybe even these last few years? We talk about our arguments over key moments in American history like the Civil War.
So there's a lot of things. One is that, you know, nowadays it's wonderful because students have right in their hands and in their back pockets access to all sorts of information that they could ever possibly want to know about the Civil War. But what they need then is the critical apparatus to make sense of what's coming at them, what's real, what's fake, what's legitimate, what's the product of real research. So on the one, it's tricky, right? Because in a way, I want to encourage and embolden all of my students to do their own inquiry. And with the use of their iPhone and the internet, they're able to do that. But it's also really teaching them, how do you navigate this barrage of information, frankly, this barrage of misinformation, and be able to put together something like a historically robust, real view of the past? That's one of the key things that I try to teach them.
And talk a little bit about the value of studying history to help us develop that literacy to examine what we encounter online, just in our last half a minute or so.
Well, you've come to my favorite subject, Rob, so thank you so much. Well, I would just say that historians, we try not to be what's called presentist. That is to say, when we look to the past, we try to understand that people in the past are living in a different time, they're different, living in a different age, they're living with a different worldview, and we try to not read them through our own standards or judge them against our own standards. So while we try not to be presentist, at the same time, we need that history to make sense of who we are now. And so the way that I think about history and the way I teach it to my students is that it's a way of coming at our long now, so that the questions that are facing us right now in 2024, at a very, very, very critical moment in our history, we're not marooned in the present without any kind of resources to figure out how to deal with this. We have a very rich and vibrant history. And then for me as an intellectual historian, it's populated by a number of thinkers and writers and artists and poets and social scientists who thought through these issues time and again.
Thanks to our guest, Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, Distinguished Achievement Professor of History at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the way we talk about the Civil War and its impact on U.S. history.